Lens number 13. We're now in chapter 11. Game mechanics must be in balance. Lens number 30 is the lens of fairness. To use the lens of fairness, think carefully about the game player's point of view. Taking into account each player's skill level, find a way to give each player a chance of winning that each will consider to be fair. Should my game be symmetrical? Should my game be asymmetrical? Two separate points. Which is more important, that my game is a reliable measure of who has the most skill, or that it provide an interesting challenge to all players? If I want players at different skill levels to play together, what means will I use to make the game interesting and challenging for everyone? Fairness can be a slippery subject. There are some cases where one side has an advantage over the other and the game still seems fair. Sometimes this is so that players of unequal skill can play together, but there are other reasons. In the game Alien vs. Predator, for example, it is generally recognized that in multiplayer mode, predators have a significant advantage over the aliens. Players do not consider it to be unfair, however. because it is in keeping with the Alien vs. Predator story world, and they accept that if they play as an alien, they will be at a disadvantage, and will need to compensate for that with extra skill. It is a badge of pride among players to be able to win at the game when playing as an alien.
I mean, that all makes sense. Reminds me a little bit of managing foot races between my sons.
Ugh.
Where the older one would want to race the younger one. It was a few years ago, so the younger one not really in a position to beat a six-year-old in a foot race.
Right.
And so I would let the little one run, and I'd hold the six-year-old back for a while. And then I'd let him go, and he'd usually win anyway, but he'd get super, super frustrated while I was holding him at the start line.
Sure.
Because he wanted to go run, and every step his brother took, he felt like made it harder and harder to win. Of course, it did.
Right.
And I was doing it so that the little guy could feel like he was being a part of a challenge instead of just being soundly defeated by someone who's measurably faster than him.
An object of derision.
Right. But, I feel like it kind of falls apart in that sort of scenario, because anyone who knows what a foot race is can tell immediately that the one being held back would have won the race if he was not being held back.
Sure. Well, you can always do laps or something, to say how many times can you get here and back in the time that's going to get there.
Well, yeah, but
so that everyone's, so everyone's still participating the whole time.
Sure.
That's one of the frustrating things about games like Risk, where it relies a lot on your starting position, and also if you're losing, leave the game. Like, you don't get to play anymore.
Right.
And many games are like that, where there's an elimination process, and it feels kind of, it's certainly not fun, even if it is fair.
PUBG does that, right?
You just leave the match, so you can start another match as soon as you're eliminated.
Okay.
So that's nice, at least. You get to keep playing the game. You don't have to sit there and watch the other guy keep winning until the match is over.
Right.
Although it would be nice if you could, because then you could learn better. That's something that Fortnite does. Lens 31, the lens of challenge. Challenge is at the core of almost all gameplay. You could even say that a game is defined by its goals and its challenges. When examining the challenges in your game, ask yourself these questions. What are the challenges in my game? Are they too hard or just right? Can my challenges accommodate a wide variety of skill levels? How does the level of challenge increase as the player succeeds? Is there enough variety in the challenges? What is the maximum level of challenge in my game?
The maximum level of challenge...
It can't go up past 11.
Definitively, it goes up to...
I thought it goes up to 10, and so then you turn it up to 11.
Well, but see, as the developer, you have to code in for 11 in the first place.
So
then you tell the players that it's a 10.
It seems like a game is defined by its goals and its challenges, then he should have a chapter called Goals and a chapter called Challenges.
Yeah, maybe. He did have several sections on goals in the last chapter, I think.
Yeah, let's see. Lens of Scrutiny. The lens of internal consistency. We need that lens for book writing. Expected value. Goals. The lens of goals. See also 15 and 4. Okay. Yeah. The lens of challenge. All right, well, it's defining challenge. Is a defining feature. Okay. Well, lens of fairness makes good sense. The lens of challenge, why is it not a larger lens? Or why are there not more of them?
Yeah, he doesn't really have all that much to say about it.
The earlier section talks about... So he's saying there are different types of balance. One of them is fairness, so then, the lens of fairness. One of them is challenge versus success. And so he's saying to keep in the flow channel, you want to keep the challenge balanced with the player's skill level.
Right.
And so, of course, you know, is there enough challenge, is it too much challenge? Does it have self-balance in gameplay? All that stuff.
Sure.
So balance type 3 is meaningful choices, which comes to the lens 32, the lens of meaningful choices. When we make meaningful choices, it lets us feel like the things we do matter. What choices am I asking the player to make? Are they meaningful, and how? Am I giving the player the right number of choices? Would more make them feel more powerful? Would less make the game clearer? Are there any dominant strategies in my game? And it seems like to me that the lens number 32, the lens of meaningful choices, is a core question about gameplay, because in any other kind of media, you don't have choices, except in insofar as whether to experience the media, and in some cases, in what order.
Right.
But in games, ostensibly, have many more choices, and so, like, this also seems like it should be its whole chapter by itself. Meaningful choices, okay, well, is it really, like, a subset of balance, or is balance a subset of meaningful choices?
Right. And then, I think that answer might actually vary some, because you can think about games that have a lot of choice, and I'm thinking here of real-time strategy games played in campaign mode, where there's a lot of ways to successfully complete most missions, right? Some of the missions will have some kind of mechanic where you really need a druid or something to get it done, and so your whole thing is kind of designed around building the druids, but for the most part, you're free to build as many archers or machine gunmen or fire cats or whatever it is that you want to make, and that represents a lot of choice in terms of how you build your army. And then there are other games, thinking of Tomb Raider right now, where every now and then you get to a branch in the path, and you know they're both going to end in the same place, and one is going to be the hard way, and it's going to have more loot in it, and one is going to be the easy way, and it's going to have less loot. So it's a really simple choice, and it really comes down to how much do I feel like taking the extra time to do it the hard way right now.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole spectrum in between these things where you have so much choice in a real-time strategy game that it almost doesn't matter, because it's like, well, do I want a footman or an archer? Well, maybe there's a mathematically correct answer to this, but the margin of error is pretty small, so unless you make the wrong choice a lot of times, you're not likely to lose. More likely to lose because you're bad at executing the game.
It's using statistical averaging to cancel out the effects of your individual poor choices.
Right. And so these are kind of interesting because one allows you very, very little choice, and one allows you a whole lot of choice, but in neither case do your choices actually have a profound influence on the outcome of the game.
It's just a matter of whether you're playing the game or not.
Right.
Huh. Yeah, the dominant strategies thing seems like the other side of that, where if there is a clear right and wrong choice, then you're not really making a choice. You're just saying, do I know the right answer or not?
Right. Well, and that's why I specified that we're playing this RTS in campaign mode, because there actually are mathematically correct choices in RTS games, and when you play multiplayer, your opponent probably knows them, and if you don't, you will lose because you built a footman instead of an archer. And
right.
He did that archer.
Because, yeah, there's a path to victory, and any other path is invalid.
Right. And so it really becomes kind of a rush to execute this known pattern and then hope that you can outclick the other guy during the actual fighting.
It's basically the same as chess, right? Like, you have a strategy that is theoretically sound, and so then it's just whoever can memorize the most steps forward in the strategy or whatever.
Yes, except in chess sometimes your pieces will never sometimes fail to kill the other pieces, and in real-time strategy games they can.
Okay, but I mean you could have a deterministic real-time strategy game where there's no random numbers.
No, I'm not talking about random numbers. I'm talking about actual tactical execution, right? So the building the army is generally the prescribed thing, and there are probably also really specific tactics for, like, you want to go in this way or that way or something like that.
Well, yeah, there's micro in... It's micro and macro in StarCraft, I think. The micro is controlling your individual units during a battle, and the macro is
what your build order and your placement is.
Right. So you can be better at micro than the other guy, and then your pieces essentially will kill his pieces even if they're outgunned.
Sure. But the point being that if there is a fixed game with fixed rules, then it's possible to find a dominant strategy.
Right.
And there have been suggestions, and I wanted to experiment with them for a while, but I haven't gotten around to it, that varying the rules of chess would give it a new life, because it would essentially eliminate the possibility that you would solve every variant.
Right.
And so you could do the same thing with a real-time strategy game, where you vary the numbers a bit, and this time archers are a little better, this time footmen are a little better, you know, this time the map is a little different, and it can change the way that you play the game, because you have to think on your feet and kind of reevaluate every time you play.
Yeah, I think Planetary Annihilation does a little bit of that, where as you go through the campaign, I don't think they do this in multiplayer, but as you go through the campaign, you collect power-ups that make your bot factory faster or whatever.
Yeah, it's true.
And so you get, that's going to change the way you make decisions, because you'd say, well, I don't usually play with bots because I prefer vehicles, but now my bot factory is 20% better. Seems like I can't ignore that.
Yeah. I think maybe the enemies also have the same tech as you do, so you'll never find yourself playing against an unbalanced foe. The AI okay. and stuff is a little weird in campaign mode, because they toned it down so that when you're playing on ultimate insane difficulty or whatever, you can actually beat them without too much trouble. Like, it's not actually that hard. I can do it, and I'm not very practiced at the game, so it's kind of strange that they did that. I don't know why.
Yeah.
There are a lot of strange choices in Planetary Annihilation. Strange choices aside, though, the point stands that, yeah, there's a lot of room for growth in variations and variants in multiplayer, I feel like, even though it might be a bit frustrating for highly skilled players. I guess you just need to introduce it at the beginning of the game before people got good at one particular variant.
Right. I just remembered a party game. I'm not sure it's a party game, but it's a couch co-op game. Can't remember the name of it right now, but it's a brawler, basically kind of like Super Smash Brothers, where you have a fixed map and you're all in the game and you're doing stuff. But it actually has a mechanic where during gameplay, something will come up that changes the rules of the game. And sometimes a player can choose how the rules change, at least between a couple of options, and sometimes it'll be random. But as a result, the game winds up being really difficult to memorize, because it is different every time. You can still just be better at it than other people, so I always lose or better at that sort of game.
Right.
But it makes it interesting, because every now and then there'll come up a mechanic that just for one reason or another I'm better at than everybody else, and it gives me a chance anyway.
So now we're at lens 33, the lens of triangularity, which I have crossed out and written risk, because I think he's just talking about risk. The triangle that he is drawn here, in the continuing trend of poor graphs, is one node, one corner of the triangle is low risk, low reward. The other corner is high risk, high reward. And then those both have a line drawn to the third corner, which is makes it more of an angle than a triangle, which is the player. So this isn't really triangularity so much as, do you want low risk or high risk? And the associated reward, or possibility of reward, I suppose.
I feel like we basically just touched on that with the Tomb Raider example I gave in the last level.
Yeah, giving the player the choice to play it safe for a low reward or take a risk for a big reward is a great way to make your game interesting and exciting. To use the lens of triangularity, ask yourself these questions. Do I have triangularity now? And if not, how can I get it? Is my attempt at triangularity balanced? That is, are the rewards commensurate with the risks? Once you start looking for triangularity in games, you will see that it's actually not triangularity, it's just risk, and stop using these goofy terms. No, that's not what he says. You'll see it everywhere, is what he says. A dull, monotonous game can quickly become exciting and rewarding when you add a dash of triangularity. Oh, man. I think he really likes the idea that he's invented a new concept. And
well, I wonder if he isn't just kind of focusing on a specific type of choice, because he talked in the last lens about involving meaningful choices. One of the first places we went was triangularity, apparently.
Risk.
And so it seems like maybe he's just kind of deep diving on this one subset of choice.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah, he has stayed in the meaningful choices balance type for this lens. He hasn't moved on to the next one.
Okay.
So, although the next one is skill versus chance. So he's kind of segueing, I suppose, into lens 34, the lens of skill versus chance. To help determine how balance, skill, and chance in your game, ask yourself these questions. Are my players here to be judged, skill, or to take risks, chance? Skill tends to be more serious than chance. Is my game serious or casual? Are parts of my game tedious? If so, will adding elements of chance enliven them? Do parts of my game feel too random? If so, will replacing elements of chance with elements of skill or strategy make the players feel more in control? I was playing Stardew Valley the other night and with Anna, and we were both in the carnival that happens at the end of fall every year. And there's a number of carnival games and things, and one of them is a pure chance game. You just pick a color, red or blue, or orange or blue or something like that. And then the game spins a dial or whatever that essentially chooses one at random. And then if you pick the right color, you double your money, and if not, you lose your money. And I think it's purely random. I don't know for sure. But Anna was...
You don't know what a carnival.
Exactly. Anna was playing, and she's like, I see the pattern. Like, she wrote down, and she did, like, 20 rounds or something like that, all at a low bet, and it's like, okay, the pattern is this, and it's worth, you know, like, it's a lot more common on this one than that one, and then she bet all her money on that, and she lost all her money. And so I was like, oh, well, like, yeah, it's more common, but if you saw it, if it really was a pattern, then you should have just bet it in small increments on the same one, right? Like,
right.
Don't bet all your money on chance. And I think that's what the difference between pure chance and risk is that in Risk, you know what the odds are, and you can find out, you can find the pattern, essentially, and bet on the winning side. And then you just have to be careful not to bet all your money at once or put all your money in one basket, right? So you don't lose it all on the off chance that this one, even though it was statistically likely to get a good result, didn't quite get a good result. Whereas in this carnival game, it's just like, well, who knows? Odds are even, apparently.
So this reminds me of, I haven't actually played the game, but there's a game that's called, like, the Something League of International Explorers or something like that.
Oh,
and it's a fun, cartoony game about being, a 19th century explorer and competing in your explorer's guild for getting to different things first and things like that. And it has some really interesting mechanics. It has a really funny way of kind of portraying combat and things like that. But this lens reminds me of the last episode of Web Streamer's series on this game that I saw, where the game has a skill-based feature where you're supposed to plan your steps, and because you have limited resources and every step takes a resource, and so you need to plan your steps, and if you make a mistake, you suffer some penalty. So you don't just die when you run out of resources, but you suffer a penalty, and that penalty is random. And then each of the steps you take puts you on a node, and what's on that node is random. And it's usually a challenge of some kind that you can overcome with the skills of your characters.
If you have a balanced group, I'm assuming.
Yeah. So you want to kind of build a diverse toolkit into your team so that you're likely to be able to succeed at anything. And then every now and then there will be a node that's just you get a bonus or just you get a penalty. And so in this last episode of the game, the streamer had planned out his moves to the last resource, and he knew that he could make it to the end boss with his last resource. But one of the nodes he stepped on very near the end was, you lose one resource.
Oh, no.
So now he's one resource short.
It unbalanced his whole plan, huh?
Right. And so as he walks on to the node with the final boss on it, he suffers a penalty for going over on his resources. And that penalty was essentially, it completely gutted his primary DPS character. It, like, made it so she couldn't use any of her abilities well.
Wow.
And so he had no chance of defeating the last enemy. I don't know that he actually had a good chance in the first place. He made a really... I didn't agree with his decision for how he chose which final boss to fight. because you can choose what you're doing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He chose the one that was like an overwhelmingly physical fight, but that's not the kind of group that he had. And he chose it because it was a dinosaur and dinosaurs are cool. But anyway, he was really frustrated because he had made this plan based on the skill-oriented side of the game, which is,
you know, sure,
generating a plan. And then he'd had that taken away from him by chance. And so while you can say that having a balance of skill and chance in your game is interesting, the game didn't telegraph before, and maybe he just got lucky and had never stumbled across this kind of penalty before, but
sure,
the game didn't telegraph that losing your resources was a thing that might happen. And so he really felt like he was unable to foresee this bad luck, and so no amount of skill on his part could have made up for it. And, you know, thinking about it, now that we know that, we can say, oh, well, just make all your plans with one extra resource in mind, just in case.
But how many is enough?
Right.
Is it two? Is it three?
Right. And all the evidence that the game had given him up to that point had been that enough is zero.
Right.
So if you're going to put chance in your game and you're going to kind of pit it against skill mechanics, it's really important that you telegraph the boundaries of that so that your players can hedge appropriately.
Right. Just like with taking risks, you want to know what risks you're taking. You don't want to just go in there and be like, well, whatever happens, I'm sure it'll be fine. Comes back to the, is it just pure randomness, or is it some kind of calculated risk that you're taking? And if it's calculated, like you said, you have to know what you're calculating on.
Right.
Be able to look at, that would be a good way to do it, is just be able to look at the deck of random things that can happen. Like in an adventuring game, it seems like you could just like tell stories and in the gentleman's club or whatever it is that your home base is, right? And like other adventures come back and you can just sit there and tell stories, and the mechanic is that you just look through the deck of all the random things that have happened to them, and so you know what kinds of things can happen.
Right.
Without experiencing them directly in the field.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, skill versus chance. It is a good point. And it seems like what we're saying is that there should be some elements of skill when you're dealing with chance, and there probably should be some elements of chance when you're dealing with skill as well.
Like, yes.
Some measurable mixture of the two.
Right. And I mean, that's why poker is a more popular card game or chance game to watch than roulette, right? Because there really isn't much skill to be had in roulette. But in poker, you can win at poker with inferior cards. So there's a definite level of skill involved there.
Lens 35. The lens of head and hands. This is balancing type number 5. Head versus hands. Yogi Berra once said, baseball is 90% mental and the other half is physical.
Well, well.
To make sure your game has a more realistic balance of mental and physical elements, use the lens of head and hands. Are my players looking for mindless action or an intellectual challenge? Would adding more places that involve puzzle solving in my game make it more interesting? Are there places where the player can relax their brain and just play the game without thinking? Can I give the player a choice? Either succeed by exercising a high level of dexterity or by finding a clever strategy that works with a minimum of physical skill. If 1 means all physical and 10 means all mental, what number would my game get? This lens works particularly well when used in conjunction with lens number 16, the lens of the player.
So that's an interesting idea, and I'm not sure I have played a game that actually successfully executes his suggestion there.
Although it seems like Overwatch has some aspects of this, where you can play a character that is more headshot-y, or you can play a character that's more movement-y, or you can play a character that is more like overall strategy placement kind of thing.
Yes, that is true. So Overwatch does do a pretty good job of it. I was thinking in terms of adventure games and things like that.
Ah.
And all the way back to like the original Jedi Knights, and including the modern Tomb Raider that I've recently been playing, they give you either-or challenges, where here's a challenge that you have to be able to execute with dexterity, and here's a challenge that you have to be able to execute with logic. But they don't really combine them, and there's almost never a branch where it's logic on this side and dexterity on that side.
Sure.
And even, I don't think it is ever the case that you can solve the same puzzle two ways, one with logic and one with dexterity. And because of that, all of the challenges, generally speaking, wind up being pretty simple right? Because they can't give you a logic puzzle that is actually hard, because then some people will be incapable of executing it. And they can't give you a dexterity challenge that is actually hard, because then some people will be incapable of executing it. And they want everybody who buys their game to be able to finish their game.
I was just thinking of the new Colossus, Wolfenstein the New Colossus, where you get a key, basically, ability that allows you to open kinds of doors. You can, like, smash through walls, or you can, like, crawl through really small spaces, or you can, whatever, I forget what the third thing. But then from that point on, the levels all have these, like, three doors in them, essentially, and you just use the key that you have. And it's never a thing of like, oh, well, if you have this key, then you can get to this special area that no one else will be able to get to. It's just like, advance using the key that you have. There are three doors. Use the key that matches the door.
Right.
and it seems like it could have been done so much better. And that the problem with the games is like the one you're describing about Head and Hands, that rarely is it possible to offer a significant challenge in a way that isn't just put the peg in the hole that fits the peg's shape.
Right.
It would be really cool, though, to have something where there's a deep, for example, conversation system or something, where, like, characters have motivations and philosophies, and if you can figure out the philosophy of the group that this person's in, then you can have a conversation with them, and that'll make them like you enough to give you the key to open the door. Or you can have a really deep lock-picking system where you can go and pick the lock very carefully, and you can see how what are they called? Lock-picks, I guess, are responding to the tumblers inside and figure out a clever way to, you know, very dexterously, execution-wise, make the whole thing, you know, unlock or something like that. And then you have both systems in the game, and you can just choose whichever system is more convenient. Maybe you like one better, you like the other better, or you just are feeling like not talking to anyone here, or you didn't do your research, or you don't have lockpicks on you, or, you know, something like that.
I think the Elder Scrolls games actually do that.
Ah.
I haven't played one since Oblivion, and I don't really care for them in general, though I don't remember why, so maybe I should play one again. But they have that where there are certain things in the game that you can get to by convincing people in the game to give them.
Sure.
Or by stealing them.
Yeah, there you go.
And there is a lock-picking mechanic, and there is a conversation mechanic. And while the conversation mechanic isn't particularly challenging, and neither is the lock-picking mechanic, they're both challenging enough that you can lose some.
Sure.
And so it does take some skill to master them. And there are some things that can only be got by one of the ways, and some things that maybe actually need both to get there. But there is a lot of variety in how you can get what you want in the Elder Scrolls games, so they may be an example of what you're talking about.
All right. Yeah, that's a good lens. It's very interesting. I wonder if there are other aspects that could be there, like head, hands, and heart or something. Have some... Because we were talking before about how it's difficult to reach the human center of Maslow's hierarchy of belonging and love and companionship.
Right.
I wonder if that's another aspect that...
Can you solve this challenge by properly empathizing
right.
with someone in the game?
Right. Not just being clever, but feeling for them.
Right.
Lens 36, the lens of competition. Determining who is most skilled at something is a basic human urge. Games of competition can satisfy that urge. Use this lens to be sure your competitive game makes people want to win it. Does my game give a fair measurement of player skill? Do people want to win my game, and why? Is winning this game something people can be proud of? Can novices meaningfully compete? Can experts meaningfully compete? Can experts generally be sure that they will defeat novices?
Seems like this is something that PUBG kind of has the market on right now.
Yeah. Well, it's got enough randomness that you can have a meaningful chance of advancing as a novice. It seems like this is just how blended do you make it in the direction of random chance.
Right.
if there's no random chance at all, then it's all on skill. And if there's, it's all random chance, then everyone gets to compete because everyone has an equal chance of winning. It shoots in ladders, essentially.
Right. I'm not super familiar with PUBG, but my understanding is that the randomness in it more or less comes from where you start and what items happen to be near where you start.
You get to choose where you start, but the item placement you don't. Okay. And you also don't get to choose where other people choose to start.
Right. And then once you have a weapon, skill more or less takes over. And there are better weapons and worse weapons and things, but for the most part, once the expert gets a weapon, he can start killing novices. And maybe there will be a novice that has, like, a truck and just runs him over. And there was nothing that his shotgun could do about that. So the novice has a little bit of a chance, but the expert can be assured of a path to victory, or at least a path towards victory, over novices, because he's more likely to be able to shoot them in the head.
Right. Which brings us to Lens 37, something that PUBG does not do very well, the lens of cooperation. Collaborating and succeeding as a team is a special pleasure that can create lasting social bonds. Use this lens to study the cooperative aspects of your game. Cooperation requires communication. Do my players have enough opportunity to communicate? How could communication be enhanced? Are my players friends already, or are they strangers? If they are strangers, how can I help them break the ice? Is there synergy or entergy when the players work together, and why? Do all the players have the same role, do they have special jobs? Cooperation is greatly enhanced when there is no way an individual can do a task alone. Does my game have tasks like that? Tasks that force communication inspire cooperation. Do any of my tasks force communication?
So this is something that I think Overwatch actually does really well.
Mm.
Where all of the best moments in Overwatch, or the majority of the best moments in Overwatch, in my experience, are times when the team works together. And so they happen when I play with friends, because I don't tend to communicate with strangers, because strangers in Overwatch are usually terrible people.
Yeah.
But when you work together as a team, you're able to do a lot in that game, and it really rewards coordinated team play. They've done a good job of building the game where a whole is more than the sum of its parts, and that winds up being really compelling in my view. And the game does one kind of curious thing that kind of undermines it, which is the game has a play of the game feature at the end of every match. And it highlights the individual who had the largest single contribution.
In a 5-second period, I guess, or something.
Yeah, the length actually varies, but it essentially, yes, it's a brief period, and who had the highest spike on the impact graph, basically.
Sure.
And a lot of times you'll have a game that was a good game and it had a lot of really good team fights. And then the play of the game comes up, and it's just somebody who, like, turned on his ultimate, stood there and, like, machine gunned everyone to death. And you don't really see the, what was going on around him. Or maybe even nothing was going on around him. And sometimes he doesn't even kill that many people. It's just like, well, he did a whole lot of damage.
Sure.
But it was still the highest peak on that impact graph, and so that's what got celebrated at the end of the game. Because the game doesn't measure, or just is designed to communicate about positive team play. And this is really shown by the way that healers are almost never featured in plays of the game. Mm. And if they are, it's almost always because they did some sort of rather extraordinary killing. One of the healers is Lucio, and he can bounce people away from himself with a feature on his gun. And the game really rewards, in terms of impact, knocking people off of cliffs.
Oh.
Because then you get credit for all of the damage that could have been done to them.
Yeah.
And their death. And so if a Lucio player manages to knock two people off of a cliff at the same time, he's essentially guaranteed to get that play of the game card.
Play of the game. Two people fell off of a cliff.
Right. And regardless of whether or not that had a strong impact on the game, and the game does try to measure whether or not it really had a strong impact, but it's hard to separate that from how much damage you...
Sure, because this is the name of the game, really.
Right. And then there's another healer, Anna, whose ultimate ability is entirely reliant on someone else. She just makes someone else twice as good, basically.
Wow.
And Anna never gets a play of the game, ever, because her damage can't be bursty. We talked once before about how in Overwatch, some characters can get headshots and some characters can't.
Right.
Anna can't. So her damage can't be bursty. She shoots at a fixed rate, and then her her damage is done over time.
Oh, sure.
So it's always spread out. So you can't get a super high burst damage with Anna. You can't really get a super high healing burst either for the same reason. But she can control the other team's healing a little bit because she can stop them from healing big targets.
Ah.
And she can make players twice as good on her team. And so there are really clever ways to use that along with someone else on your team to isolate an important person on the other team, usually a tank or something like that, that has a really high impact
sure.
when he's there.
But, focus him down.
Right. And prevent him from being healed. Double the effectiveness of one of your own players, and then that player will go in and get play of the game, just murdering everybody.
Right.
And so the players can give Anna some credit because they'll see, and they usually include Anna's ult starting at the beginning of this other player's play of the game. But a lot of these things wouldn't be possible without the contribution of that Anna, and so this is kind of a fundamental example of where Overwatch breaks down at properly communicating and rewarding one of its best mechanics, which is that it is a game that strongly favors.
And one in which it's nearly impossible to succeed without strong team.
Right.
Which brings us to Lens 38. The lens of competition versus cooperation. It's a competition between competition and cooperation. Why can't we have the lens of the cooperation between competition and cooperation?
It's competition with cooperation?
No, this is versus, okay. Unfortunately.
They hate
and
each other.
I don't think there's a cooperation of competition and cooperation there, so... Another book, perhaps. Balancing competition and cooperation can be done in many interesting ways. Use this lens to decide whether they are balanced properly in your game. If 1 is competition and 10 is cooperation, what number should my game get? Can I give players a choice whether to play cooperatively or competitively? Does my audience prefer competition, cooperation, or a mixture? Is team competition something that makes sense for my game? Is my game more fun with team competition or with solo?
Yeah, that seems like a lot of what we just talked about.
Yeah. It's a good question.
Yep.
Lens 39. The lens of time. So there's in between here. So we've just exited balance type number 6, competition versus cooperation. We had 3 lenses in there. And then there's balance type number 7, short versus long, which doesn't merit a lens, apparently. And then there is balance type number 8, rewards, which has, looks like 2 lenses in it. The first being the lens of time. It is said that timing is everything. Our goal as designers is to create experiences, and experiences are easily spoilt when they are too short or too long. Ask these questions to make yours just the right length. What is it that determines the length of my gameplay activity? Are my players frustrated because the game ends too early? How can I change that? Are my players bored because the game goes on for too long? And how can I change that? Seeing a game time can make gameplay more exciting. Or setting a time limit can make gameplay more exciting. Is it a good idea for my game? Would hierarchy of time structures help my game? That is, several short rounds that together comprise a longer round. Timing, of course, can be difficult to get right, but it can make or break a game. Often, it makes more sense to follow the old vaudeville adage of leave 'em wanting more.
Another thing that I think Overwatch actually, where generally, and obviously there are exceptions, but generally speaking, the round length of Overwatch is really, it's short enough that if you need to sit out a round, go get a drink in the kitchen or something like that.
Sure.
It's fine. Just let your friends go on and you'll catch them in the next round. It also has a spectator feature, so you can come back halfway through the round and watch the eating part of that round. But it's long enough that generally you feel like you had enough time to really execute on your plan and done what to do.
To do the thing you had hoped to accomplish.
Right. And then one of the things that makes it compelling is it has a way to make it longer, essentially, if you are losing.
It's an overtime.
Right. You can put games into overtime by seeding. And the only way that that really goes into overtime is if you are the one currently in a losing position. So you're trying to defend a base and the enemy is on your base. And essentially, they just have to stand on your base for a certain amount of time and then they win. But if you can continue getting people to your base to stand on your base, their timer won't tick forward and stay in overtime. And some of the most compelling games are ones that stay in overtime for a long time. And so it gives you this sort of feeling of having the clock in a certain way. But it also really kind of showcases the way your team has come together, because the other team has been winning this whole time, and win in overtime, that you have changed something about the way you are playing the game, and in order to succeed.
Sure. A game that seems to be entirely too long almost all the time is Dwarf Fortress.
Yes.
And while it does succeed at having nested time structures to a certain degree, where you can have like combat and combat time in really short rounds, and you travel in long periods of time, or things like that. Seems like you could do with a great deal more of that kind of thing, where you can abstract away a lot of the nitty-gritty.
Right.
There's altogether too much granularity most of the time. It'd be nice to be able to step back if you skip some stuff. And then he has a whole list of other types of rewards. So I guess not going on for too long is a reward. But then he's got a list of praise, points, prolonged play, a gateway, spectacle, expression, powers, resources, and completion.
They're on the first page. I'm really hoping all of his were going to start with.
Yeah, he had such a strong thing going, and then powers at in the middle there.
He was halfway there.
It's gotta read a book about writing books. And then two other reward rules of thumb are people have a tendency to get acclimated to the rewards that they receive. So try to vary them. And a good way to keep people from being acclimated is to not too. That's just one point. Oh well. Lens number 40, the lens of reward. Everyone likes to be told that they're doing a good job. Ask these questions to determine if your game is giving out the right rewards in the right amounts at the right times. What rewards is my game giving out now? Can it give out others as well? Are players excited when they get rewards in my game, or are they bored by them? And what? Getting a reward you don't understand is like getting no reward at all. Do my players understand the rewards they are getting? Are the rewards my game gives out too regular? Can they be given out in a more variable way? How are my rewards related to one another? Is there a way that they could be better connected? How are my rewards building? Are they too fast, too slow, or just right? Balancing rewards is very different for every game. Not only does a designer have to worry about giving out the right ones, but giving them out at the right times, in the right amounts. This can only be determined through trial and error. Even then, it probably won't be right for everyone. When trying to balance rewards, it is hard to be perfect. You will often have to settle for good enough.
That's definitely something important to look at in games. And it's interesting how many games I've played recently that really don't have a really compelling reward structure. Like Tomb Raider, as you progress through the game, you get upgrades for your weapons, so your weapons get better. But the challenges all get harder along with them, and generally weapon upgrades are just like, your weapon can do a new thing, and it's a good thing because you're sure going to need that in the next fight. And you can upgrade things faster, and there are like mechanics in Tomb Raider where you can go back to a zone and like get all the stuff, and you probably can't get every weapon upgrade unless you do more of the completionist stuff. But the rewards wind up feeling, well, one of the rewards in Tomb Raider is just completion, right? Like, I'm just trying to finish to get more of the story.
Sure.
And it does a fine job there. But in terms of material reward, powers and prizes and things like that, all of it feels pretty scheduled. And some of it is obviously and explicitly scheduled. Like when they give you the fire arrows, the next fight, you're in a field that's just littered with fuel cans because you're going to need to blow up so many things. So it sure is a good thing you've got fire arrows now, because if you didn't, you couldn't blow up all the things.
Wow.
And
so that's not really a reward so much as just the next step in the game progression.
Right. And then Overwatch gives rewards whenever you level up, and you level up just from playing. You do level up a little faster if you win a lot.
Ah.
Because Overwatch is a competitive game that is trying to be sport and balanced and stuff, like, none of the rewards have any impact on the way the game's played at all.
Ah,
so
sure.
They're all cosmetics, and maybe for a little while you're like, well, I wish I had this skin over here or something like that. But I, at least, am not really compelled by cosmetic rewards.
Right.
So the whole reward mechanic in Overwatch for me is just kind of like, huh, that's weird. But I guess maybe this goes to what Seamus Young was saying about Black Desert Online, where the whole way they make money is just by getting you to buy cool-looking outfits. So maybe I'm in the minority here, not really caring what it looks like.
I guess. Well, then again, how many games like Black Desert are there? They can't be too common. Maybe they are.
Well, my experience is that most free-to-play games have an avenue, at least, for making based on appearance.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a new Harry Potter mobile, and one of the ways, there are basically two ways that they make money. And one of them is you have a fixed amount of energy, and or a limited amount of energy, so only meaningfully play the game for so long every day.
Sure.
But you could buy more energy with money, so if you really want to play some more, you could pay money.
Right.
And then the other one is you can buy clothes for your character. You can customize the way that they look, and the clothes cost gems. And gems come through regular gameplay, but they come really slowly.
Mm.
So if you're just dying to build the perfect outfit for your Harry Potter character, you are going to have to go spend $5, or maybe a lot more than $5. I haven't actually looked at how the economics on that work out. But you're definitely going to need to spend some money on it. And then Overwatch does the same thing, except worse, because to get specific skins in Overwatch, you have to buy a bunch of loot boxes and hope that you get them. Or just buy so many loot boxes that you wind up getting enough money to buy them. And then Black Desert Online, you, again, just buy stuff. So I think that's actually pretty common.
Well, there we go. Lens 40. We got through another, how many was that? Few lenses. 30 through 40. 10 lenses today. It's take a long time when we have so much to say about them.
Yeah.
We've got to stop thinking so much, I think.
All right. He frequently wants us to stop thinking.
Well, he stopped telling us to stop thinking. Yeah. That's the problem.
Maybe we're allowed to think.